And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to welcome Wai Tu Moore to the program today. She's the founder of the international nonprofit organization One More Book. Her writing has been featured in publications such as the Paris Review, Guernica, The Atlantic, and others. Today we're discussing her debut novel, She Would Be King, which follows three characters who return from slavery or exile to help with the early days of Liberia in the 19th century. Wai Tu, when you first started writing what would become She Would Be King, did Bessa or another character come to you first, or had you originally just wanted to write a story about the early days of Liberia?
So when I was young, there's an aphorism that exists in my mother's ethnic group, the Vai people, and the aphorism is, you know, be kind to cats. And the reason that they wanted you to be kind to cats is because they tell the story of an old woman who beat her cat to death. The cat jumps to the top of the roof after he's dead and kills the old woman. And this is something that was passed down for some generations. And in 2008 or so, I think before that, I had only been writing short stories and maybe poetry. And it was my first try at writing African literature. Actually, it was a friend of mine at the time who encouraged me to give a shot at it. And I wanted to write or expand a story that I'd been told growing up. And so that aphorism, the very short, be kind to cats, remember the old lady, beat her cat to death, the ghost of the cat jumped on a roof and killed her. And I gave it a shot in 2008, and I wrote about this old woman and her cat's death. And then I began to ask myself a question. So what happens after this? What happens after this old woman kills her cat? And of course, during this time, when I wrote it out, I gave her a name. I gave the people in the village names and personalities. But I very much wanted to explore the history of Liberia, that's for one. And taking a shot at writing about this woman and her cat, it sort of gave me a window and an avenue into the exploration of the Vai people, which they are an indigenous group in what is now Liberia. And Liberia has 16 indigenous groups. And yeah, so it was just a path of exploration.
Now, the Vai people had come to that area a couple of hundred years before. Is that what
happened? Yes, 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 from Mali. And so because they came mostly from like the north and the east, they were previously colonized and indoctrinated by the Arabs. So they're Muslim. And they moved to the region. And so a lot of the ethnic groups in northern Liberia are Muslim. And then the rest are Christian. And that's because of the American and Caribbean settlers that moved there in the 19th century.
Now, there's a first-person narrator for the book, and the narrator is omniscient, and we don't want to give away kind of the identity of the narrator. But why did you make the choice not to tell us who's telling us this story?
So the book was initially written in third person, and I changed the narrator to a first-person narrator because I think in telling Bessa's story, and Bessa's the heroine, I thought that it was important that this story and the story of Liberia be told by an ancestor in some way. And I didn't want that ancestor to be Bessa because a lot of what she was experiencing was external to her. And I wanted those characters and those storylines to be fleshed out as well. And so the narrator that I chose, the first person narrator, was who I consider the most accurate ancestor of Bessa's and the most accurate portrayal, I would say, or marriage of the complexity and the nuance and the musicality that is being a Black woman. And so I specifically chose the narrator who I chose because I thought that she was the one who could fully tell Bessa's story and the story of Liberia.
When Bessa is born, she becomes entangled with the story of the woman and the cat, and it has profound ramifications on her life.
Yeah, yeah. So during that time, like I told you before, the Vai people, they're Muslim and then they're Christian. They're largely Muslim. Some of them are Christian. But those colonial religions exist alongside their superstition and their spirituality. Like they did not expel their previous religions, which were very respecting of their ancestors and of nature, when they were introduced to Islam or to Christianity. And so you find my mother, as I said, is Vi. They're so superstitious, the most superstitious people I've ever met. And so because of that, there are things that even now my mom will tell me, make sure you don't do that or this will happen. And in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, that sounds ridiculous, but this is something that she fully believes, and I respect that. And so within the story, there is, because this woman kills her cat, Bessa, who is the heroine, is seen as cursed. And it just so happens that Bessa actually does have a supernatural ability. But previously, what the villagers would do or what the elders would do is, if someone is deemed cursed in some way or bringing the village bad luck, then they would be condemned or exiled into perhaps the forest or the woods with the intention of killing them. And so this is something that I wanted to delve into as well, is the role that superstition plays in the eventuality of some of the lives of the villagers.
And she was deemed a witch. And this is a time in when, still in Europe, women are being tried for witchcraft as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the really wonderful things about even having conversations about this book is being able to talk about some of these comparisons between African deities, spirituality, and religions versus what was going on in the West at the time. Because I think, unfortunately, within the continent, what was happening, obviously because of imperialism and colonialism, is a lot of these things were being suppressed. Adherence to the ancestors, engagement with the supernatural, they were being suppressed because they were seen as lacking civility and decency. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. There were things that were going on in Europe a comparable time. Maybe it would have been obviously before that, probably a couple hundred years before that. You had the Salem witch trials. And so I think the difference is that because Black bodies are seen as uncivilized, then whatever they were doing was considered uncivilized. And it wasn't even a consideration to compare it to what was going on in Western countries. It was just automatically, what these Black bodies are doing in this place that is deemed barbaric is not right.
Even if they have parallels to what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. So I've enjoyed talking about that specifically, especially even the genre, speculative fiction, magical realism. I think that there is a natural interest in speculative fiction that's coming from the continent of Africa now. And my book sold in the end of 2015, but we received a lot of no's because we were getting told that, hey, outside of YA, literary fiction, speculative fiction, we're not sure because it's not quite sci-fi. And if you call it magical realism, the comps are all these very old people. And, you know, she's a young writer. So there was a lot that was at play. And obviously, I'm so happy that we were placed with Grey Wolf because they gave me an opportunity and they gave the story an opportunity. And then fast forward 3 years to 2018, Black Panther comes out. And then there's a peak in the interest of speculative fiction that's coming from the continent. But I guess I remind people that it isn't new. It isn't a genre that's just being explored by diaspora writers. This is something that was suppressed for a very long time. And it's more or less diaspora writers connecting to this very organic way of storytelling. Because when I was growing up, I never heard stories that didn't include someone flying or shapeshifting or disappearing. It was just a part of the architecture of story. But those things weren't spectacle. Like if you and I are talking and I say, hey, I want to go to the restroom, and I stand up and I fly to the restroom, in the Western canon, me flying becomes spectacle and becomes a subject that's worth dissecting and analyzing. And if I tell the same story in a Vi village in Liberia, me flying is not even anything you would think of. You would say, well, was she angry with the man before she walked away? Or why did she abruptly leave to go to the bathroom? Was she angry? Actually, you're discussing more universal themes as opposed to magic as spectacle. So these conversations have been wonderful because it's tapping into and recognizing this very culturally authentic and culturally organic way of storytelling that diaspora writers are now being recognized for.
Well, and you even look in the Bible and the Quran, and mm-hmm. you will see miraculous things happen. It's just which person do you think is responsible for these occurrences makes the difference, it seems.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Now, we do follow three main characters in the story. We have Bessa, and she has red hair. How unusual is that?
I would say as red as I made her hair, that is unusual, but Vi women, my mother, I remember looking at my mom's hair. My mom's a very dark-skinned woman. She has beautiful, almost oil-black skin. When I was growing up, there were strands of her hair that looked blonde. And she shared with me that the women in, and obviously this isn't her because she spent a lot of her life in the United States raising us in Texas, but she would tell me that Vi women, two things that a lot of them had in common, because some of them were working on the rice farms, was that very light brown hair, as obviously in proof that the sun had an affectation toward them, and then lines on their neck. And that was a mark of beauty, not wrinkles as what would be considered in the West. And so remembering, obviously, my mom saying that in the glimpses and vignettes I have of playing with her hair in my childhood and realizing that some of the strands were very brown, wanting to also make that true of Bessa, the heroine, but embellish it in a way that I think highlighted some of the mystical qualities and intents of the book.
While most of the town, the village, shuns her, there's a boy named Safwa, mm-hmm. and he shows her kindness.
Mm-hmm. I've been a fan of the fantasy genre for a while, and what I've find throughout, whether or not the story is being told in the West, East, South, North, wherever, is that these characters tend to come from vulnerable backgrounds. And I think in general, what makes them not use these gifts that may or may not be realized for evil is the loneliness that they feel upon realizing that they have gifts, and the loneliness they felt or the rejection and isolation they felt before that realization is when that loneliness is met with companionship, then I feel like in most storylines, and you can look at Marvel, X-Men, or whatever fantasy you indulge in storytelling, and it's always that friend or companion or showing of love that softens the superhero. And that's something that I think is important to engage in, because I would like to think that if I had a superpower there, I think we've all maybe fantasized about what we would do if we had superpowers. And I would like to think that I know exactly what I would do and who I would save, but you sort of just never know.
Let's hear it. What's the power?
I think I would be interested in invisibility, right? Invisibility or the ability to absorb other powers. And I know those two are diametrically opposed.
Well, that's like wishing for more wishes.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, I think that's the most strategic wish is to have, you know, somewhat being able to absorb other powers and indulge in other powers, and then invisibility. So one is a very quiet gift, and the other one is tremendously loud. But I'm curious about both of them, because what would it be like to exist in this world silently? And then what would it be like to be all powerful, you know?
I'm sorry to go geek style on this.
No,
right here.
Let's go.
But if you're to absorb powers from others, should there be a limit on that you can't hold on to the powers ad infinitum?
Yeah.
That you can only hold them for special time? So the way to attack you would be send really weak people at you?
Oh.
Because you absorb their weakness?
Yeah, or maybe like logistically the way that could be designed is if an individual absorbs too many powers, then they're unable to use them, or their body just doesn't know
overload.
How to control. Yeah, like they suffer overload, so they have to find a way to relinquish some of them. The question?
we're going back to Safwa showing her kindness.
Yeah, so, and I think that kindness plays a huge role in both her story, the stories of the other gifted ones in the novel, and then also the stories of most superheroes that I've indulged growing up, either through literature or through oral history or through film.
It seems that heroes and villains often have very similar origin stories, and there's one point that sends them either direction.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying, and I choose to believe, and obviously this could be argued because people have different ways of analyzing the art that they indulge, but I think that point is a person. It's that act of kindness or being showed generosity. I think that that's what shifts what makes a hero and what makes a villain. What do you think?
I think it's kind of how we're born.
There's
more and more genetic stuff coming out saying your disposition is kind of what you're born with.
I think to some extremes, right? If you're thinking about like sociopaths and psychopaths and things like that. But I think the majority of people, it really just depends on environment, right? Like I think that shift.
Your society that you're in. Most people go along to get along. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So Safwa comes from an important family in the village. La or Lai?
La.
La. There is a true life society known as the Poro Society, and his family was part of that. Who are the Poro?
The Poro, they're actually a secret society, so I made them more visible in the novel, but the Poro and the Sande societies are secret societies that exist in West Africa, and I know in the Vai context, the Poro men ended up being warriors. They protected the village. But their initiations, who was chosen, that was kept largely private. You knew that Poro men became warriors, but not all warriors were Poro. They also ended up being the judges in given societies. The Sande women, they would go into the bush and they sort of learned how to be good wives in, of course, the Vai context, the Vai historical context. And so they're secret societies, but in the novel, I chose to make them visible.
There is a couple in the story that are kind of like the doctors for the area. And of course, they have root knowledge and more traditional medicines. What's the breaking point between witch and root doctor or doctor in a society?
The witches are more or less condemned at birth. And because this is a spiritual culture, they then subscribe to the idea that someone can be taught nature and someone can elevate themselves spiritually to where they connect to ancestors and bring some of the healing knowledge from ancestors to their people. Whereas a witch is condemned at birth. So if you're born, as was mentioned in the story, if you're born on the day of an eclipse and it's like, oh, this is a bad, and if you're born the day an old woman kills her cat, then that's bad luck. And so this person should be condemned. So anything that seemed that is more environmentally caused sometimes and as a function of birth or twins, they can be condemned as well. That doesn't seem natural, but that doesn't suggest that someone can't learn how to heal and connect with their ancestors and bring some of that knowledge down to the villagers.
It seems that the predilection to condemn people and shun them and expel them from society, you know, it's all around the world.
Yeah, it's universal.
But I wonder if it's almost kinder that it's done so randomly and without saying, oh, you're a bad person and we don't like the way you dress. It's just happenstance.
Right.
If that's kinder in some way.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I guess I haven't thought about it of whether or not that is more kind than outright prejudice.
It's just the luck of the draw. That's about a point.
Yeah. But I will say that within this society that was created, there was a prejudice toward poorer families, right? They weren't given the same treatment. They sort of, if they were poor, they had to go work out in the swamps. And so I think it's human nature to create systems of social stratification. So that's evident in this society as well. It just so happens that that's coexisting with this spiritual system of understanding life on earth that's present as well.
For our next character, we go to the Emerson Plantation in Virginia, and we don't meet the next main character, but we do meet an enslaved woman named Charlotte, and she's been shunned in her own way from the other women that work in the kitchen at the plantation.
Yeah, so Charlotte, she witnesses a young girl getting chastised by an overseer, and she believes that during that encounter, because she didn't interject her because she didn't help the young girl because she was so young and she was the only one there who could help her, that's the reason why other slaves are rejecting her and ostracizing her in the ways that they are.
So it seems to be a common theme of people being ostracized in their own communities.
Yeah, that isolation, I think, is important in building worlds where the supernatural exists.
Now, there's another young woman, Darlene, and unfortunately she's caught the eye of the plantation owner, Mr. Emerson, and the ire of his wife.
Mm-hmm. It was very hard to write that section, actually, because when you're writing about politicized times, you're talking about race, specifically during slavery, during the colonialism era, I had to disengage from my tendency and desire to rage write these characters so as not to make them seem as caricatures. I went about the relationship between Darlene, who is a kitchen slave, and Mr. Emerson, who's the master, initially as something where she was always depressed by. And I remember reading some texts that explore the notion that some women who had caught the eye of the master, as you would say, would use those relationships to protect themselves and to protect their families. And I remember reading and being shocked by that and almost offended and closing the book like, well, no, that can't be. But as I said, I had to disengage with my binary thinking and with my understanding of history and really try to write characters who were true and try to write characters who were in very desperate situations and as a function of that were doing what they could to survive. So Darlene understands that she is born with skin that makes her somehow less human than those who are born white. She's born on a plantation as a slave, and the master of the plantation begins to treat her very kindly, buys her gifts, makes her think that what's going on between them is consensual, and she mistakes that thing as love. And of course, she learns later on that that's not the case, and I don't want to give too much away, but that was very hard for me to write because I really needed to look at Darlene's relationship with Master Emerson, as well as the other people who were alive during this time, in the context of their reality, not my understanding of what was going on at the time and what I would do at the time, because I think that's all very presumptuous to assume that I would know what I would be doing if I were alive during the civil rights movement or if I were alive during slavery. The texts that I've read show that some of these relationships were being used, and those who were enslaved were strategizing and doing what they could to protect their families, given the hands that they were dealt. And the same thing goes for the relationships between the Black settlers to Liberia and the Native groups. I think the historical texts that were available to me all portrayed that relationship as very tense and stifled, and that the Blacks went back from America and the Caribbean and they treated the Native groups just as poorly that they were treated in the United States. And that's untrue as well. Yes, there were systems of social stratification that were created. Yes, there was an endemic national favoritism that lasted up until the coup in 1980, but there were also co-marriages. And during the coup, some of the cabinet members who were killed, they were mixed. It wasn't as black and white as what's been portrayed. And so I think that in disengaging from my tendency to write history based on my understanding, I was able to approach some of these relationships and some of these human beings as just that, human beings.
Mrs. Emerson, the slave owner's wife, she seems unable to blame her husband,
right,
and blames only Charlotte.
And I think that's just I'm probably guilty of that. And so at some point in my life, if you know my partner does something wrong, then I'm always looking at these external factors that played a role in his misbehavior as opposed to looking at what's in my face. And I think that a lot of times that's a function of the patriarchy, actually. Like, men are sort of blameless, and so we should sort of look externally. What is this other woman doing to seduce my husband, as opposed to what was really going on, which is actually this other woman is owned by your husband, and so your husband has power over this other woman. And so I think, obviously, racism was at play in that relationship as well.
She is given a baby. We won't describe how the baby has come to her, but she's given this baby. And that has accelerated the mistress's poor feelings about Charlotte.
Right, because she assumes, you have to remember that during this time that the illegitimate children of these men, slave owners, were being moved into the house. And they were being moved into the house to play with the children who were already living in the house, the missus's children. And they were being moved into the house to serve the misses. And so I think another, speaking of binary thinking of history, I know intraracially there's a conversation about field slaves versus house slaves and field slaves getting treated so poorly and house slaves getting preferential treatment. And while in some cases that's true, in many cases, the house slaves were subjected to even more cruel and brutal punishment, both physically and psychologically, because in many cases, they were the illegitimate children of the master. And so at the hands of the missus, a lot of them suffered abuse because they were reminders of the infidelities and the mistakes and misbehaviors of their husbands.
But also proximity, just
exactly,
just sheer physical closeness,
exactly,
means they're at hand and they're mm-hmm. the ones that can be abused when yeah. they're outraged.
Yeah, but I mean, conversations about slaves during that era, you would think that those who were on the field, because obviously they're doing the field work and the hard manual labor, the perception is that they were treated more cruelly. But also research shows that those who were in the house were subjected to cruelty as well.
The main character of this section is Junde. Mm-hmm. He is known as Junde, but he only knows his name to be Moses.
So Junde is raised in the house, and he really cares for Darlene, who is his adoptive mother, and the other women in the house. And it's in this context that he's realizing that he has power. And he, of course, doesn't know what to do with it, so he keeps it quiet for a while until he experiences or something happens where he has to use his power to tap into his gift. But he is constantly wrestling, and I think all of the characters are constantly wrestling with this gift that they have, maybe with the exception of Norman Arrigan, who's always trying to tap into it. But that's because he was raised by a woman who told him very specifically that you should try to tap into it. But without that very direct call, Bessa and Junde are wrestling with the power that they have for a while and somewhat hiding it.
Finally, we have Norman Aragorn's section, and it begins with a white British scholar named Callum Aragorn makes his way to Jamaica to study the Maroon people of Jamaica. Who were the Maroons?
Yeah, the Maroons were former slaves who rebelled from their British slave owners, and they rebelled during two wars, and they ran up into the mountains in Jamaica. And after the Second War, what the British did is they signed a treaty with them that essentially said, okay, you can stay up here, but if any other slaves try to get up the mountain, you have to return them. And they would actually pay them to return other blacks who were going up the mountain. And in some cases, the blacks were able to stay and escape there and form their own colonies. But in other cases, they were, you know, dragged right back down to the plantation. And so the Maroons are interesting because historically they were Africans in Jamaica who very much stayed in touch with their spirituality and spiritual beliefs. And in some texts that I read, it did say that Maroons were able to tap into some of that spirituality. And it said that people on the island thought that they were practicing witchcraft and obey and other very ritualistic things in order to tap into the powers of their ancestors. And so I found them fascinating. One of the things that I wanted to explore in the book was these communities saving themselves, or members of these communities sort of serving as their own saviors. Because I think that in the novels that I tend to read about slavery, there is usually an abolitionist perspective or an abolitionist that's featured for good reason, for good cause. But it was important in telling the story of Liberia because it did have so much to do with these black bodies from across the Atlantic, from the three corners of the Atlantic, making sense of this new country for themselves. Even though when Liberia was initially settled, there were white governors. The capital city, Monrovia, was named after U.S. President James Monroe. There's a Virginia in Liberia. There's a Buchanan in Liberia. And it was very much a little America. It was modeled after
the flag. Is
the
very
flag.
Similar.
It was very similar, exactly. And there were white governors who were present in Monrovia at the time, and they governed this new settlement up until from the 1820s or so, when the American Colonization Society began to go over, up until 1847, when Liberians claimed their independence and became sovereign. But I intentionally didn't include the white governors as characters because I think that it is important to show some conflicts that exist intraracially. Like, how do black bodies with who've all been indoctrinated in different ways, who are in some ways still suffering from the psychological inheritance of slavery versus the psychological inheritance of colonialism versus the psychological inheritance of, you know, what was existent, the social hierarchies that were existent in their villages at the time. And if they all come together, what does that look like? What would a nation like that look like? And that is Pan-Africanist in essence. But I knew that in order to give myself the space and give my characters the space to figure it out, then I did need to sort of ignore this other context that was very present during that time.
Why did the Colonization Society pick that area? You talked about presumptuousness earlier.
Yeah. So along that coast, the French were already dominating. And I think that this was just an area that was designated as unexplored, undesignated at the time. Because the British colony of Sierra Leone had been set up around the same time. And then the French were all along the coast. And actually, the French ended up, after Liberia claimed its independence, cutting what was designated as Liberia into half. And so they ended up continuing to fight these colonizers and imperialists in maintaining the land that was designated by America as theirs. And so I think what helped, obviously, is proximity. You're going to try to find some land on the western coast of Africa. And I think other Western powers already had claim to other land during that time.
Back to Jamaica and Cal Maragorn. He needs an entree into the Maroon society. A white man will not be trusted for good reason. He is essentially given a woman named Nani to help him out. Who is Nani?
So Nani is a Maroon, also has a gift. She realizes that she has a gift, and she tries to tap into this gift to escape from the plantation back into the mountains. And for the most part, her gift can only be accessed if she is close to someone else with a gift or if she's up in the mountains. And so she gets caught and she gets given to Callum, but luckily he needs to go up into the mountains to conduct his research. And I think what Nani realizes, I'm not free up in the mountains, and the brutality of this very place that I am, it's just not for me. So then she sets her sight on returning to Africa, to Sierra Leone, because the British had designated some colony in Freetown that they shipped some of the Maroons to after the Second Maroon War, just as a way to get rid of some of them and decrease the Maroon population in the mountains. And so Nani had her sights set on Freetown because she'd grown up hearing about it. And so she ends up using this relationship with Callum to try to get herself to Freetown.
And there's echoes back to the Emerson, Mr. Emerson's slaveholder, because, again, not an equal relationship.
Yes.
It is enslavement.
Yes, absolutely.
Norman inherits a gift from his mother as well, and he has a desire to go to Freetown. He inherited that from her as well.
Yeah, so Norman is the illegitimate child of Nani and Callum Aragon. His mother tells him from a very young age that this is not for us. This place is not for us. We have to find our way back. As I stated before, tries to tap into this gift to get to this place that his mother so seems to admire and believe that is their salvation.
These characters find each other in Liberia, but almost as soon as they come together, fate's winds cast them apart again. This is not a traditional narrative that we know in the West.
No, it is not at all. It is not at all. And as I was stating before, these are the stories that I was used to hearing. None of the stories that I was used to hearing had straight narratives. Boy meets girl, boy loves girl, boy and girl have conflict, boy and girl separate for a while, boy and girl find their way to each other and live happily ever after, right? There was no such formula. You'd say, you know, boy meets girl, boy meets other girl, girls, something happens to girl's uncle, and you have all of these narratives that are very much part of the through line and overall theme that is being supported by all of these tangential narratives. But I think the stories that I was told growing up were, it was a form of realism, form of maximalism, because you're sort of everywhere and wanting to tell everyone's story. Everyone is in some ways a star of this story. The central star is the theme. You're focusing on the theme. That is the most important, I would say, in my understanding of storytelling and how I was introduced to storytelling, is the theme is the star. And then these characters are sort of just feeding into this theme.
The critical response for the book has just been tremendous. How does that feel to put your baby out there and then to have people love it so much?
It's been surreal. Liberia's history is very closely linked to American history, so I do think that some of the reception is because of that. It's this part of American identity that has mostly been unexplored, and so I think that the response to it is, oh yes, there's this other part of us that we have not recognized or have not had access to, and this gives us a glimpse into it. So that makes me happy because it means that this relationship with very small West African country is being recognized in a way that may heighten its profile, and that makes me happy. And also giving access to other Liberian writers and artists gives me hope. I'm excited then about where Liberia literature will go from this. I'm saying because now there's a comp, right? That's how the literary industry works. It's based off of comps. So that makes me excited. The reception of it, I'm beyond grateful. I've been working on this story for so long. It took me a year to do a first draft, and I finished that first draft in 2009. I put it away for 4 years, picked it back up in 2013. Then I edited from 2013 to 2015. It sold in 2015 and didn't come out until 2018.
Oh, gracious.
So this is about a 10-year journey. So all I can say is I'm so, so grateful. And if I can, to anyone who's listening, just encourage you to continue going however long it's been in your journey of this unlikely story that you want to introduce. Just keep going, and hopefully something will come of it.
I went on to Amazon to research, not to buy books, support your local bookstores, but research. I saw several children's books.
Yeah.
With the name. Are you involved with those?
Yeah,
you the same?
So I have a nonprofit called One More Book, and One More Book publishes and distributes books for children who rarely see themselves in books. And we focus on children of countries with low literacy rates and just underserved cultures. And we also build libraries and book corners. We opened our first bookstore in Liberia in 2015. And so we have 23 books for the children of Liberia, Guinea, Haiti. We have an Afro-Brazilian book, and we're working on one for Ghana now. And when I came up with this idea, I'm not a children's book writer, right? When I came up with this idea, I mean, I can admit, I was very frustrated with the literary industry because there's an expectation bias that exists when it comes to those who have marginal identities. If you're LGBTQ or a woman or a POC, then there's an expectation of what you should be writing or what will sell, at least. And that's also, I think, one of the reasons that it was so difficult to sell my book. And so because of those frustrations, I reached out to my sister, who's an illustrator, and I asked her if she'd be interested in collaborating on a book, and said, but it's going to be something like J is for Jollof Rice, and that's very culturally relevant to Liberia. And I went back to Liberia, had this book with me, and I remember showing it to some students, and they giggled. They giggled because they were confused as to why Jollof Rice, something that is very true to their day-to-day lives, is on a page. And that was a profound experience. And I was like, there's an issue with this because we're essentially accepting and normalizing other people's cultures as the standard. And so I used a couple of children's books that I collaborated with my sister or my brother, who's also an illustrator, on. And I went to writers and illustrators from the countries that I was interested in featuring and asked them if they wanted to collaborate. And so that's our model. We work with writers and illustrators from these featured countries or from these underserved groups to create culturally relevant and authentic stories that can then be used in schools on the ground. Domestically, we're actually distributed through Scholastic book clubs. And because the books also have a dual purpose of exposing children in the United States to cultures they may otherwise never have a chance to visit. And so it's been just a great learning experience, and it's been wonderful to partner with these other artists who recognize that there is a need for culturally relevant material. And some of the research that I have been doing also, both under the umbrella of my nonprofit and otherwise, is trying to find how do we assess the usefulness of this. Like, we know that there's psychological benefit. There have been sociological tests, like the Dahl test and others, that prove that cultural relevancy is something that should be paid attention to in the arts, so whether it's books or film, etc. But when you're talking about curriculum and things that are found in schools, like how can I prove that if a child is being shown a book about jollof rice, that it's going to elevate their test scores or classroom performance compared to books about peach cobbler and baseball and things that are not relevant to their culture. And so I've partnered with the Ministry of Education to find data, and as well as the University of Liberia, to aggregate data that will show us maybe or disprove that culturally relevant material makes a difference.
But does it have to be put into a number form? There are values beyond that.
Absolutely. And as I said, obviously psychologically, it's been proven that it has an impact. I think where the data counts is that then all of a sudden there's an understanding as to why some students are taking longer to grasp classroom material. And then we can act. We can do things that perhaps make it an even playing field.
Has She Would Be King found distribution, or is it printed in Liberia?
Well, not yet, but I'm actually making a trip there in a few weeks to go and distribute some books. And also we'll have books available at my store. So Macmillan International obviously has an arm that distributes to bookstores across the world. So I'm so excited to go back. I've been talking to Liberian writers, intellectuals, just about the different things that can be done with this book and with other books, and how we can sort of introduce Liberian literature, not just to the West, but at home as well, and make sure that it's normalized and make sure that it's part of the academic system and the Ministry of Education's curriculum.
How many other books did you work on while She Would Be King was ruminating? And
yeah, so I have a memoir that is also coming out with Grey Wolf. I believe it's likely going to be next winter. And then I have been working on another novel, which also is in the speculative fiction realm and genre. And actually, it's about this, I can give you the premise. It's about a little girl who is bullied. She is pushed into the water, into a lake during a field trip by a bully, and realizes that she could breathe underwater. So in many ways, exploring the myth of Mami Wata and mermaids and what people, again, vulnerable person does with powers once given to them.
I hope that one doesn't take 9 years.
Well, I hope not. I'm a good way through, but we'll see. I mean, I don't have any expectation or urgency when it comes to that. I just want to make something that's good and true to me and true to my craft.
Oh, and if you'd like to say hi to anybody in Memphis.
Of course. Hi to my grandma Dinah and my auntie Janice and my cousins, Jaja and Marquita and Cadero and Janice and Albert, and just my family out there, my Uncle Wayne. And I'm grateful that I had an opportunity to spend some of my childhood in Memphis, because Memphis was such a great place too, because we had so little that my parents, specifically my mom, she did use fantasy and speculative fiction in our storytelling to help to expand our imaginations and help us to see the world as what it could be and not what it was in the moment. So I'm grateful for Memphis, and we'll always love Memphis. I was here this morning.
Well, you too. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's been very much a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Wyatt Moore is the author of She Would Be King, a novel published by Grey Wolf Press. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.